to say a few words about our moderator today. I'm sure you all know him. It's Alan Koller. Alan Koller has been covering business and markets as a financial journalist for about 50 years. Last words from me before I let the experts sharing their knowledge and their expertise on the topic with you. Please keep on liking us on social media. Keep on following us to help us support our community of little business operators who obviously have been severely affected by the lockdown and by this lockdown number 5 in Melbourne. I will now give the stick to Alan, and I wish you a very great discussion and debate this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much, Nathanael. It's very nice to be here, and I'm delighted to be hosting this panel, and what an excellent panel it is. And if I could just introduce each of them to you, we have first Katie Allen, who is the member for Higgins. Hello, Katie. Louise Davidson, who is the CEO of the Australian Council of Superannuation Investors, ACSI. We have Augustine Honorat, who is the CEO of NG, and we have Shane Walden, who is the CEO of ANL. Now, ANL is a part of the CMA-CGM group of France, and obviously NG is a very large French company that also operates in Australia to a large extent. So the way we'll operate today is that there'll be a discussion that I will lead to begin with of the four. Hopefully it'll be elucidating and informal and interesting. As Nathanael said, we're on about net zero by 2050, net zero emissions by 2050, and whether we can achieve that without compromising economic growth, which, as he says, is a big topic these days. And I thought perhaps, I wonder, Katie, if we could ask you to talk a little first about the Australian government's policy on this and where we stand in Australia, perhaps just to get some clarity about it. Because the current policy of the government is to achieve net zero emissions, preferably by 2050. I guess I'm interested to know whether you think that we'll join the rest of the world and drop the word preferably at some point this year, maybe.
Thank you, Alan. Lovely to welcome to everyone who's online. Thank you for joining us in this altered, pivoted experience that we have with COVID. And thank you to all who are joining me on this panel, and I'd like to pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land in which we all separately meet, and pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging. And I think it's fair to say that the people online will be very interested to know what the federal government wants to achieve when we look to Glasgow in COP26 later this year. And certainly as a backbencher in the Morrison government, I am also very keen to know what we will be doing to commit to a 2050 target in Glasgow. The most important thing to say is I'm not the executive. I am actually a member of the Morrison government that contributes to decision-making, and I am a strong voice for climate action. And in fact, I've written opinion pieces about the fact that it's no longer an environmental imperative, it's an economic imperative. In fact, I think it's an economic inevitability. So in my view, Australia has to get there, and the question is how we get there. And I've been a very strong voice with regards to making sure we have meat on the bones for a plan to get there, or to at least be able to say to the Australian public what is it that we are committing to, because in all of these discussions there are many voices and there are many differences of opinions, and the commitments that the government has made to Kyoto and to Paris have been commitments that have been delivered by subsequent governments. And I think Morrison government is pleased that it has committed to the Paris Agreement and that it will reach its targets that were set out for 2030. But now I think we, as a globe, are looking to seeing more ambitious targets. There are some in my government, some across Australia, who would say that you know, we wouldn't want to do it at an economic cost, and why should we do it here in Australia? But I believe that we have a very important role to play, not only because we contribute to global emissions, but we contribute and punch above our weight with regards to our global leadership. I think we're a real respected voice, and we need to show leadership in this area. And there's a lot of talk about targets, but I do think that that's also important that we talk about the technology that will get us there, because there is a lot of discussion about the different types of technology, but we also need to look at the cost of getting there as well. And I think having an honest conversation about what the technology that will be used, what the alternatives are, and what the costs are of getting to these outcomes are very important, because otherwise we're just kicking the can down the road for others to deal with further along. And it'd be very easy to make a discussion point that we'll get to 2050, but if we don't have at least some cogent idea of what is at stake, what is the cost to the economy, but also what is it cost with regards to whether we've got stranded assets or stranded jobs, I think it was a very important part of that conversation. It is worth pointing out that that Australians themselves have been enthusiastic uptake. People have taken up renewables, and per capita, I think we are using solar per capita at a higher rate than anywhere else in the world. It is also worth saying that we have achieved our targets as well as any other country, and in some cases better than other countries. We're doing better than the OECD average with reduction of emissions. It's not good enough, and it's not going to get us there fast enough, but it is worth pointing out there are some positives. And I think it's also worth pointing out that Australia has got some clear opportunities with regards to solar and wind, with battery technology, and also with the development of hydrogen. And I think there's a lot of interest in the low emissions technology statement. And what I will say is that what we bring to the table from a technology point of view is a very pragmatic approach. And I do back in the low emissions technology strategy of five stretch targets. This is the first time that we've had a strategy put on the table in Australia. And I encourage anyone who is online to read it. You may agree with it or disagree with it. The point is, it is something tangible, and it is very commercially orientated with regards to a stretch target for hydrogen being under $2 a kilogram, looking at clean green steel and aluminium, looking at battery technology, looking at carbon soil, and it has actually put commercial numbers around it. So instead of arguing about something that is something we all wish for, it's actually putting some pragmatic goals on the table. And it was encouraging to see Joe Biden's administration take up those five stretch targets and include them themselves. But what I would say, and this is going to be me on the front foot and being controversial, is that Joe Biden added a sixth stretch target, which was new nuclear. And when I mean new nuclear, I'm talking about small modular reactors, as another stretch target for technology. And I'm on the record as being someone who's very open to the idea of including nuclear potentially in the mix, not old nuclear. I'm talking about third or fourth generation nuclear, new nuclear or small modular reactors. They are a decade away at least. That will be very expensive. But if you look at the countries that have legislated a 2050 target, many, if not all of them, perhaps with the exception of New Zealand, which has a carve out for agriculture, and Finland, they all have nuclear somewhere in the mix. And we are talking about Bastille Day today with the French online, and the French have been big enthusiasts of nuclear, with I think 70% of the electricity market nuclear invested. But what I will say as a final point, because I don't want to take up too much more time, is that actually with regards to all the different parts of the pie for emissions, the electricity sector, which is where most of the political debate has been, is actually the best sector with regards to emissions reduction. And if you look at the National Emissions Quarterly Report, there's been a 5% drop. And what we're seeing is also a drop in emissions for transportation, and that's probably mostly because we're not flying overseas and we haven't been using cars through COVID. And so you can see a reduction in energy intensity because of COVID, not because we're doing better from a technology point of view or from a transportation point of view. But most people seem to think that the energy sector is transitioning, getting there. What we really need to do now is pay more attention to other sectors, including transportation, and an electric vehicle strategy would be incredibly important to that, but also stationary energy and the conversion of our gas in our houses, and with regards to our heating, looking at our building code, looking at our agriculture and how we can best pivot to that, looking at our cows and sheep and making sure that our ruminants taking on new technologies such as CSI, which is producing things like seaweed probiotics to help reduce methane loads from emissions from our agriculture sector. And there's a whole lot of opportunity that I'd like to see all levels of government working towards with a plan to hopefully therefore be able to get to a target, so that we can feel proud to be Australian and part of the global discussion with regards to emissions reduction.
I know ACSI has made a firm commitment yourself to net zero emissions by 2050. And I just wonder how you think about the trade-off between growth and that target.
Oh, thanks, Alan. Just to provide a bit of context to those on the call, my organisation is a membership organisation, and our members are large investors, large superannuation funds, mainly in Australia, but some international as well. And we help our members with integrating environmental, social and governance considerations into their investment portfolios. We have a particular focus on listed companies in the Australian market. And our members own roughly 10% of companies in the Australian market, and so have a really strong interest in making sure that companies are really working towards being sustainable, profitable organisations over the long term, because as you'd appreciate, superannuation is a long-term investment. So climate change has been a big concern for our members for quite a long time. And I guess, Alan, in response to your question, my argument would be that if we don't really grasp this issue and start to make significant action and progress, then none of us will be able to enjoy growth, because there will be quite significant economic disruption over time. So from our perspective, we are really keen to see a commitment to net zero by 2050, but not only that, also to see medium and short term targets set out as well, so that everybody knows how we are actually going to get from A to B. You know, I think in the early days there were a lot of commitments made about net zero by 2050, and some concern about there not being a pathway to get there. So, which I think, Katie, was part of the point that you were making there as well. That's definitely our view. So from an investor perspective, there is a huge amount of risk with not taking action on climate change. And that includes the risk of stranded assets. It includes the growing risk associated with severe weather events and the insurability of assets. And it includes also the opportunity cost. If we don't, in Australia, move to a stronger acceptance of new technologies and, you know, renewables, etc., then our industry will lose the opportunity to be at the forefront of that. And from an investment perspective, that's not what we want to see.
Thanks, Louise. Perhaps I can now turn to Shane Walden. Now, Shane, I note that your parent company, CMA CGM in France, is targeting carbon neutrality by 2050. So I want to ask you firstly whether that means net zero emissions, or does it mean something else in your view? And also, I think the question, I suppose, that fascinates me is, does this mean we're going to have electric ships? Can we have electric ships? Because I note that ANL and CMA CGM are really just going to LNG at this stage, from diesel to LNG. And you're talking about electric ships, but I'm wondering whether that's really viable. Take us through what's going to happen with shipping, which is a big deal.
It is, Alan. And first of all, it's great to be here with you and the rest of the panelists and the audience as well. As you mentioned, I mean, from a shipping line perspective, we have a big role to play in terms of the global emissions. So if we look at the global shipping industry, we emit 940 million tons of CO2 per year. So that equates to 2.5% of the global emissions. So there's clearly an opportunity for shipping lines to make a difference. And I think, as Katie said, you know, what's important is that we need to act now. If we have a look at the shipping industry, it's proved to be quite a useful indicator to the health of the global economy. So far, if we look at the Australian trade, volumes are up by 30% year on year, as household savings are strong and people continue to spend money in the market. So moving forward, we're not seeing any indication that this growth will abate. So one thing that we are focused on is that how we can provide efficient and sustainable supply chains, and at the same time continue to reduce our carbon footprint. Alan, you mentioned our target, and it is net zero emissions by 2050. I think what's also just as important, as Louise indicated, is to ensure that we have some short and medium term goals. A big part of our strategy is to ensure, and one of our short term targets is to ensure that 10% of the fuel we burn are renewable fuels by 2023. So that's just around the corner.
Does that mean biofuels? Is that what you're talking about, biofuels?
It's mainly focused on biofuel. So our group 3 months ago made a significant investment in biomethane in Europe. We bought 12,000 tonnes of biomethane, which is effectively enough to power two small vessels in Europe. In addition to that, as you mentioned, LNG is an important part of our strategy. So we operate 550 vessels globally. By the end of next year, 40 of those vessels will be operated via LNG. So, you know, we completely appreciate that LNG is a transition fuel. It reduces carbon emissions by around 30%. But it's also important to reduce the SOx and the NOx as well. In addition to that, we talked a little bit about not just biomethane, but what we're also looking at in this particular market is renewable methane. So Louise indicated that there's a big agricultural sector here in Australia. If we look at the methane market at the moment, I think there's less than 1% of the nation's electricity, which is powered by biomethane. But if we take that a step further and have a look at renewable methane, Australia has plenty of sunshine, plenty of water, and plenty of cheap land. So what we're looking at the moment is companies that can produce tech in order to produce renewable methane going forward. So to answer your question,
Shane, how do you make renewable methane?
So it's effectively CH4. So you effectively take the you split the hydrogen out of water. You use sunshine in order to mix with carbon, and then effectively you end up producing renewable methane, which is different than the biomethane, which is traditionally produced by waste. So our initial investments is just as much around certificates of origin and make sure that we can actually invest at origin. But moving forward, we see a future whereby our vessels can be powered by methane. And this is an important part of our strategy, in particular to ensure that we can set up these green supply chains.
I'll come back to you in a moment later, Shane, but first let's hear from Augustine now. Augustine, I'm really interested in ENGIE's transformation because as GDF Sewers, it was largely a fossil fuel company to some extent. I mean, the company owned Hazelwood Power Station, which was the most polluting power station in the world, I think, and obviously it's closed now. But in 2015, ENGIE around the world began a transformation and now is a renewable energy company. So tell us about that transformation and what it's involved, please.
Yeah, thanks, Alan, and good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for having me in that Pasti Day festival, which is very close to my heart, as my accent tells. I'm French originally, so... look, ENGIE is a large energy company, one of the largest in the world, probably. And as you said, I think the particularity that we have is that we have transitioned ourselves from a largely fossil fuel company to a much more renewable company. We have decided to go for net zero by 2045 globally. And one of the big steps that has been taken, as you said, was to decide to divest and to exit coal a few years ago. It was a very tough decision because coal was an important part of the energy mix of ENGIE, was a very important aspect of the electricity generation that we had in many places and in Australia in particular. But we thought that as a company, the cost of staying in that specific part of the industry would be too high in the long term. So we decided to make that move. It was not an easy decision, as I said, but we divested coal. And in Australia, we had a corresponding reduction of 95% of our carbon footprint. And today, not only are we targeting a net zero for ourselves, but we also offer that as an offer to our customers. And the purpose of the company has been changed a few years ago, and we decided to have as a purpose the support to our customers to reach net zero or to start their transition, their energy, their own energy transition. So we are doing that for governments, we are doing that for cities, we are doing that for companies, large and small, and we are doing that also for individual customers, for residential customers. In Australia and in Victoria in particular, but in many other states, we have a brand called Simply Energy that sells electricity and gas to customers. And another example of that energy transition is we decided at the beginning of this year to offer to our customers carbon neutral electricity and carbon neutral gas. So that's part of any contract that customers can sign with us. We don't have other contracts. They are all carbon neutral now. And we offer that at no extra costs to customers. So
do you achieve that? Excuse me, do you achieve that with by buying offsets? Is that how it's done?
Correct. That's the way it's done today. We also buy renewable electricity, but we buy offsets to make sure that it's fully carbon neutral. And we are doing that in other parts of the world as well. So the idea is to push that to customers. Of course, some customers are very interested in that. Some are less interested, but no one refuses because it's at no extra cost, right? And we think we have a role to play here to try to push that energy transition with our various customers, residential or energies or companies or governments.
There is an extra cost. All you're saying is that energy is swallowing the cost, right?
Yeah, correct. And the reason we do that is that because we think it's a great way to attract new customers and to have more customers. Because we saw in our market studies that in many parts of the world and in Australia as well, as was said a bit before in that panel, we see a rising demand for those carbon neutral offers or for renewable energy. And we think that offering that to our customers will attract them to our offers. And it's not just residential customers, it's also companies that come to see us every day. And I think as we said, many of them are driven by their shareholders or by their boards that say, look, guys, we need to go for carbon neutrality. So please do that. And then those customers come to see us and say, how can we decarbonize our energy? Can you help us do that? And that's why we have developed a small advisory company inside that help our customers design those objectives and design the roadmaps that they need to develop and to implement to reach carbon neutrality at some point in time. Some say 2030, like for example, Monash University, and we are working with them. Some say 2040, and that's the example of Springfield City Group. And some say 2050, and we work with all of them to help them on that very exciting journey.
Katie, I feel like every time I ask you something, it's like loaded because you're a government MP, and I don't want to you to think that I'm trying to get you to say something, you know, that's controversial, although of course that'd be great. But I'm just interested because Augustine talked about the transformation that ENGIE has made, which has been rapid, really. I mean, from a fossil fuel company to a renewable energy company. And to do that, they've exited coal. Do you think that Australia needs to undergo a similar transformation? I mean, we are a fossil fuel country. Do you think we need to exit coal and go down that sort of path that ENGIE has gone down?
Yeah, thanks, Alan. And, this is a controversial area, and that's why people like me put my hands up to go into politics, is we are making decisions not just for ourselves but for the future of our children and their generation and those who come after us and for the future of the planet. So these are tough conversations, but they're conversations I'm very prepared to have. I'm a pragmatist, and so, I prefer to know what the technology is, and I prefer to know what the aims are, and I need to know what the plan is. And I think those are the things that the countries that have actually committed to a target are now being pushed on? Or what is your plan to get there? So it's not one or the other, it's both. So I'm pushing on both fronts. So I'm like, I want the plan, but I also want the target. But when it comes to looking at Australia, I think we do need to remember that you're right, we have been a resource-rich country and we need to transition to other resources. And so the sorts of resources that people are talking about is, in the short term, it's likely to be gas. And the thing about getting on through the transition plan of gas is that you can get off coal quicker, because we can use it as a firming and peaking form of energy for our renewables. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing is that people don't really realise in our electricity sector how dependent on coal we have been. So as short a time as just a few years ago, 85% of our electricity was from coal. Now that's dropped to about 72%, and it's predicted to go down to 68%. But to get from 72% to 68% costs a few billion dollars. So it does cost money to get you down that scale. And you also need to have the ramping up of renewables. So we are ramping up renewables at speed as a country. We have got a massive uptake of renewables. So that has happened from an investment of both levels of government, state and federal government, into incentives to get people to buy solar. And the sort of investment into the area has helped to get that area of technology off its knees. Now, as a scientist myself, that's what I see one of the roles of government to do, is to invest in new technologies, particularly early on, to get them kick-started, then to use its own purchasing power to provide some economic powerhouse into it, to really stimulate that sector. But I am a bit technology agnostic, because I am a free marketeer, and I do believe that it's good to let the market then take over and move into that next phase, into the more developed part of the market. One thing I would like to see is the federalism aspect of Australia really activated. So as we know, through COVID, federalism has worked both well and not so well. So the good aspect of it was the national cabinet. The bad aspect of it, we can see, was a little bit of bickering across the borders. But what I really like about federalism when it comes to technology, having a science background, is when one state leads the way with regards to its energy assets and shows other states how to do it. And so what I would like to see is national emissions budgeting going on based on state by state, because then it really can expose to us what's happening in the different states and which ones are leading the way and which ones are doing better than others. So you can look, you can drill down into that data, but it's not so publicly available. And you can see, for instance, South Australia has got a very high level of renewable uptake, one of the highest in the country, and it has a very low dependence on coal. Now that's replaced by about 50% of it with gas. And so they are using gas in that transition way, which I really back in, because you can turn it on and turn it off quickly, and then you can rely on renewables when you need to. And they have a very small percentage, of course, also backed in with batteries, which they're trying to grow as a capability. So they've got that Tesla battery in there, which is giving 100 megawatts of battery, which gives about an hour and a quarter at the moment. But there's a lot more investment and technology that needs to go into making sure that those batteries can do their job for longer. But one last point I would like to make is, as we transition off what we talked about, stranded assets and potentially stranded jobs, we need to build new industries. And I think that's where government has a really strong role to play. And I sat next to someone at a dinner the other day, and he talked to me about lithium. And I think the critical metals in this country are really probably going to be that, as well as hydrogen, are probably going to be the powerhouses, resources of the future. And he said to me and just to make sure I get this right, that at the moment, I think Australia exports about 90,000 tonnes a year of lithium, which is about $14,000 a tonne. So it's a couple of billion dollar export market. Within 9 years, the sector itself is predicting that 90,000 tonnes of exports are expected to go up to 2 million tonnes of exports. And that's because of the appetite around the world for electric vehicles. So each electric vehicle needs about 9 or 10 kilograms of lithium. So there is a market that's going to grow quite rapidly, and we want to be shipping it on boats, not on airplanes, by the way, so that we can make sure our emissions stay as low as possible. But lithium is one critical mineral, I think, which will help fuel our future. But of course, there's other things like nickel as well, and other rare metals that Australia can really build into with regards to our resource sector. And of course, we also need to be able to work out how to pivot jobs away from the resource sector to other things as well.
Louise, I'd like to get you to pick up on the role of government as well. I was just really interested in what Shane and Augustine were talking about in terms of the fact that, those companies, their companies, have committed to net zero by 2050, and they're talking to other companies. And I'm aware of, a big voluntary carbon market that's around the world where NGOs are issuing carbon certificates, companies are buying them, there's a sort of private markets taking place. It's not just all about the government, but when you talk to investors and think about your own role in this, what how important is the role of government, or can it be done to a large extent by the companies themselves and voluntary markets?
Yes, well, I think the role of government is very important. Nevertheless, that we are seeing a lot of energy and activity from companies in moving to position themselves to be ready for this transition that they see as inevitable, as do I think all of us on the panel here. So I think, so it's really very interesting actually for us to be, working with companies over a period of say the last 10 years and to see the difference in the way they are thinking about this. And when I refer to companies, I guess I'm thinking particularly at the moment about companies, Australian companies that have a high exposure to climate, whether that be in the mining sector, so your BHPs and Rio Tintos, or say in insurance. The insurance companies have been very early movers in this regard because they could see the typhoon heading straight to them. And so the focus of companies has been very strong, but I do think that it's more difficult for them to act in isolation, and that government policy is a really important support for what they want to do. And part of, I think part of the risk for companies as well, or part of the concern that companies have now, is that if we don't end up in a position where government policy is supporting the work that they think they need to do, then they might be on the wrong side of trade barriers and trade tariffs and so on as a consequence. And, that companies that we speak to don't want to be in that position, of course.
No, and we're already seeing that with the EU introducing its carbon mechanism.
Yeah, and we don't have a lot of, Australian companies are not that exposed to the Europeans, but the US has also hinted if the US and Japan, say, and Korea were to move in that same direction, then that would be very impactful.
Well, one of the other things that seems to me that's important about the government's role is the fact that although a lot of companies are committing to net zero by 2050 and doing what they can, not all companies are doing it. And so therefore, it tends to be, there tend to be freeloaders among companies and individuals. And the only way to even it out, to make sure that everyone contributes, is by government making it a rule across the board.
Well, I think that's exactly why international, overseas countries are saying, well, hang on, we can't let other countries be freeloaders in this. And that's why we're talking now about, trade implications. But I think, I guess there might be some freeloaders, Alan, but to be honest with you, most companies that we talk to, most Australian companies have pretty big global exposure. And they can't afford to sit back and wait. They know that they have to move on this. So there might be pockets of inaction, and there might be some companies where there's more talk than there is action. But I think on the whole, most Australian companies who have a strong exposure, a big exposure to climate, are starting to move.
Augustine, what do you think is going to happen with steel and cement primarily? I mean, how are they going to be decarbonized?
Look, that's an interesting question, Alan, because these are precisely two sectors that are looking at greenifying their production, steel and cement. And by the way, we have a number of customers in those industries that came to see us and say, look, and I'm thinking about a cement company that we helped recently decarbonize their electricity that we sold renewable electricity to. And the reason why they came to us and asked was, look, there is, of course, I think they were concerned about climate change and about the planet, and that's great. I think there was also an element of how can this green cement be a marketing argument to convince more of their customers and to differentiate against other competitors. So I think that for certain companies and apparently more and more, they really see carbon neutrality as a great way to differentiate and to convince more customers. So it's not just a constraint that those companies put on themselves. It is also a conscious decision to be better and to sell better products in the future for their customers.
And yes, how much more expensive is green cement?
Well, it really depends. Each situation is a case by case basis. In that example that I'm giving, the contract was sufficiently long term for us to be able to build a wind farm or a solar farm that could create electricity at a cost that was extremely competitive with the market prices. So it doesn't mean necessarily that green electricity is more expensive than traditional electricity. Depending on the circumstances, it can be either same cost or even more affordable in some cases. So it was really that argument that the company wanted to use, and that was the cement industry. And in the steel industry, we see that more and more with the use of green hydrogen that is seen as an important feedstock in the steel industry. So we have more and more customers coming to see us and say, look, can you help us replace methane by green hydrogen in the process? And that's very interesting because green hydrogen, I think, as Katie Allen mentioned, has a lot of potential here in Australia. Australia is blessed with natural resources, with sun, with wind. So it is easy to produce electricity on renewable sources. Add to that an electrolyzer and you create green hydrogen. And green hydrogen will be the potential for that, the demand for that, the global demand for that will be strong from Asia, from Japan, from South Korea, from China, probably from the EU. So we really see Australia being a potential powerhouse in terms of green hydrogen that could progressively take over LNG. And LNG is a very important aspect of the Australian exports right now. So we see a lot of future for that green hydrogen here and for customers here, but also for export markets.
Shane, will zero emissions or net zero emission shipping cost more? And how much more is it likely to cost? And also while you're at it, I mean, you probably, I know you guys don't run planes or anything, but what's going to happen in aviation? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, so Alan, I mean, if we look at the shipping industry to start off with, if we look at the lifespan of a ship, the lifespan is anywhere between 20 and 30 years. So clearly we don't have time to wait. With our policy around LNG, that was 7 years of R&D in order to deploy our first LNG vessel, which was deployed last year. I think if we move forward, and just picking up on Augustine's point, is that what we're finding is that some of our big customers, whether it's BHP, whether it's Wesfarmers, whether it's Woolworths, they're producing more and more green commodities, whether it be green steel or other commodities, and they're demanding green supply chains and wanting to measure their carbon footprint. So we're continuing to work with our customers to ensure that, first of all, they can measure their carbon footprint. Second of all, they can bring their carbon footprint down. And then to your point, the cost can be passed through the supply chain. So if we have a look at the size of the vessels that are operating in Australia at the moment, the average size of a vessel would be 5,000 TU, which is a 20-foot equivalent unit, which is effectively a one standard 20-foot container. Once we pass that cost through the supply chain, and once we break that down to say a pair of sneakers or a pair of jeans, the overall cost is only a few cents per item. So I think the supply chain will bear it. Clearly, from a transport perspective, we are ready and we're already taking steps, whether it be in the short and medium term with biofuel or LNG, or whether it be in the longer term with hydrogen. And I think our customers, as I said, are demanding green supply chains. So I think overall, we are expecting that the supply chain will be able to bear the costs. In terms of aviation, I'm far from an expert on that. Our group started an air division only 6 months ago. Clearly, we have a lot of work to do in order to bring the emissions down on the aviation. But for the purpose of this discussion, I think I'll focus on the shipping side of things.
Fair enough. Katie, you're a scientist, pediatric scientist, but you keep an eye on these things. And I just wonder, firstly, do you think that net zero by 2050 will be enough? Will that do the trick? And secondly, what could derail it? If you look globally, for example, China has a big challenge. It's got net zero by 2060, which is a bit later than everyone else, but it's got it's got huge challenges to even meet 2060. So what do you reckon?
Well, I think, you're quite right to pick up that, China, the US and India are the big emitters, and if China doesn't sort something out, we're all in trouble. And that's why I suppose as a scientist I kind of have this sense of hope, because science is actually very able to come to our rescue so over and over again. So to your original question is 2050 target enough? It has to be. But often what happens is once technology transformation happens, once there's a tipping point, or you can think about penicillin for antibiotics, or you can think about vaccination, or you can think about the iPhone, you can think even about electric vehicles. I mean, once you get a tipping point and then you get commercialization behind it, and the free market backing it in, then that tipping point comes and things move very rapidly, which is why I'm actually quite hopeful about something like small modular reactors, because if the right investment goes into the right outcome and then everyone gets on board, then you can get there even quicker. And I've seen over and over again, whether it's cell therapy or gene therapy or all sorts of technology, where we sort of are stumbling around in the dark and then suddenly there's a sort of an iPhone moment or a tipping point moment, and things happen very quickly after that. And while we don't know what it is at the moment, we have to progress all of these different areas. So we need to keep on investing in renewables and batteries to make sure we can store renewables. We need to keep investing in developing hydrogen, green hydrogen, to see if it can actually help electrification of the planet. But we also need to work on all these other parts of the sector as well. So it's almost like mushrooms, pushing them all down. We need to work on all fronts, and it is exhausting for people. And, for the person in the street, for the voter in the street or the constituent in the street, they can sometimes feel very overwhelmed that, where's all this ineptitude coming from? And it isn't just about government policy, and it isn't just about businesses. It's also about the demand side of individual consumers. And so, making sure that people have the opportunity to make the right purchasing decision, whether it is, to do carbon credits for their flights, or whether it is to buy an electric vehicle, or whether it is to recycle, whether it's to walk to work so you're fitter, or is it whether it's to convert your gas heating at your home to an electric form of heating, to help bring the emissions down at a personal level. And the government's role is to make sure that people can make the decisions in an economically sound way, but also in an easy way. And to me, what's frustrating at the moment is it is very hard to behave well. And, even things like looking at emissions reduction to your own house, there are all these technologies that are available right now. You can go down to JB Hi-Fi and get what's called a voltage clamp. You can put it on your house, and you can actually smooth out the voltage. It's produced by a local company called Edge Energy, and it smooths out voltage variation, because the energy companies don't have any incentives to not oversupply energy to you, and they want to make sure that they have good supply. And so they oversupply voltage to you, which burns out your appliances and increases your energy bill, but more importantly, increases your emissions bill. And so there are a lot of technologies that we can use at an individual level. And those are some of the really practical things that state governments and even federal governments can get involved in, making it easier for consumers to make the right choice in all that they do. So it's not just the big government response, not just the community business response, it's also the community individual citizens response. And then you've got to, you know, take that up in magnitude to the whole globe.
Well, thank you, everyone on the panel. It's been fantastic, I think. Thank you, Katie Allen, the member for Higgins. Thank you, Augustine Honorer, the CEO of Engie in Australia, Shane Walden, the CEO of ANL, and Louise Davidson, the CEO of ACSI, the Australian Council of Superannuation Investors. It's been great. Thank you very much, everybody. Over to you, Natanael.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot, Alan. And it's always a pleasure to have you on board with all the French Association and Francophile and association in Melbourne, to have you on board as a guest, as a specialist, as an expert, and we hope that we'll be able to work with you again very soon, not online but physically. I would like also to thank all the panelists. It was really great to all have you. Have a wonderful evening and a wonderful Bastille Day French festival.
Thank you.
Merci beaucoup.
Thank you.
Au revoir. Bye bye.